Good morning again, and welcome to the second session this morning on globalization and the Gulf. The backdrop of this was well set out in the earlier session. It is, of course, a world economic crisis, the severest crisis of the core, certainly since 1945, which has spread from the core across the world. It involves the intersection of at least two phenomena, financial crisis emanating from the Anglo-American world, which is spread across the world, intersecting with a real economy in crisis and in some vicious circle together. These economic challenges have given rise to many pressing issues, including the degree to which the financial market activity has over time become dislocated, as it were, from real economic trends, the high levels of risk in the system, the insufficiently backed risk in the system, and the high levels of volatility to which it could give rise, a reward system that looks questionable at best, if not illegitimate and quite dysfunctional, certainly for long-term financial security and stability, the emergence of severe global economic balances, and of course a governance crisis, not just within national economies and within regions, which Sir Howard Davis has referred to, but a global governance crisis as well, which the G20 may or may not address in a few days' time, most likely probably address only in part. To help us explore these issues, and particularly the intersection of them with the Gulf, I have three speakers here who will look both back in time and forward a little bit at some of the pressing problems ahead. And these three speakers are, the first to speak will be Professor Gregory Gause, the second Professor Giacomo Luciani, and then finally Will Hutton. I'll just say something briefly about them before giving Greg the floor. Greg Gause is a professor of political science at the University of Vermont and was director of the university's Middle East Studies program. He was previously on the faculty of Columbia University and was fellow of Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York. He's currently a Fulbright scholar at the American University here in Kuwait. Among his books are Saudi-Yemeni Relations and Oil Monarchies, and he has a forthcoming text with Cambridge University Press looking at the Persian Gulf region more broadly, as I understand it. The second speaker, Professor Giacomo Luciani, is senior advisor at the Gulf Research Center and director of the Gulf Research Center Foundation in Geneva. Since 1997, he has been professorial lecturer in Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University, the Bologna Center. Currently, he also teaches at the University of Lausanne at the Graduate Institute of the International Development Studies in Geneva and at Sciences Po Paris's Menton campus. Finally, and the last to speak will be Will Hutton, Executive Chair of the Work Foundation, an independent research-based consultancy, which is the most influential voice on work, workplace, and employment issues in Britain. Will has written several best-selling books, including The World We're In, The State We're In, The State to Come, The Stakeholding Society, and his last book was The Writing on the Wall, which challenges the view that China's rise is inexorable. In fact, the argument is that China's economic and political system is highly flawed in certain ways, and what has given China great advantage in the last 20 years may not give it advantage in the decades ahead. He no doubt will speak to these issues later on. I think he takes the broad view that the future still lies towards the Atlantic Alliance, certainly the American part of that alliance, and that the rise of Asia, important that it is still fraught with major systemic problems, many of which will manifest themselves in years to come. So please welcome our first speaker, Gregory Gause.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. I indeed was for 10 years the director of the Middle East Studies program at the University of Vermont, and I always say that that's a little bit like being the Prince of Liechtenstein. I controlled everything I surveyed, but I didn't survey very much at all. I note that I'm the only American on the program as a speaker. Our agenda is mostly, except for me, speakers who are affiliated with British institutions or speakers who are affiliated with institutions here in the Arabian Gulf. The But since I'm talking about 100 years of globalization in the Gulf region, I think it's probably appropriate because 100 years of history here in the region is a little bit, to some extent, the story of Americans kind of inserting themselves into what had been exclusively a British regional interaction. And so perhaps this is somewhat symbolic of what we've seen in the last 100 years of regional history. I want to just offer up a few thoughts on the phenomenon of integration into the global economy here in the Gulf region, more as suggestions for research and reflection than as fully formed conclusions supported by a lot of empirical research. That is to say, I didn't have time to really do a lot of research on this. Clearly, the extent of local integration in the world economy is greater today than in the past, and thus more consequential on a number of levels for people who live here in the Gulf region. But it's my contention that such integration is different only in degree, not in kind, from past periods in the history of this area. Right? This region has been integrated into Indian Ocean trade patterns for some time, centuries, if not millennia. While the economies of the Gulf littoral were not particularly rich, right? They were not like the agricultural-based economies of their neighbors in the Nile Valley or in the Valley of the Tigris and the Euphrates or in Persia. Right? What economic surplus that was generated here on the Gulf littoral came from integration into the global economy. Right? Whether that integration was through trade with India and East Africa, or whether on the Red Sea side of the Arabian Peninsula, that integration was through one of the oldest examples of what today we call globalization, the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. These kinds of integrations into the wider world through trade, through population movements, through what today we would call tourism, generated what meager economic surplus there was in this region. Right, which was mostly subsistence-based economy, oasis farming, fishing, animal husbandry, raiding. Right? And so while globalization here in the region, or what we would call globalization today, integration in the world economy, was not very extensive, it was extremely important for generating what economic surplus there was in the area. If we think more recently to the first decades of the 20th century, before oil became the major factor in the local economies, we can see this pattern. Right? The pearl trade was a globalized industry. It employed considerable numbers of people on the Arab side of the Gulf. It generated most of the regional surplus, economic surplus in the area. And then two worldwide phenomena struck at the pearl industry. One, of course, the Great Depression, which enormously reduced world demand for luxury goods like pearls. And, of course, technological developments, the development of the cultured pearl industry in Japan, right, which vastly increased the number of pearls on the market and lowered the demand for Gulf pearls. These two global, if you will, phenomena, one economic and one technological, really destroyed what had been the core export industry of the Arab side of the Gulf. And if we look at the other side of the peninsula, right, the Great Depression so severely cut into the pilgrimage traffic, which was at that time the single major source of revenue for Abdulaziz ibn Abdurrahman al-Saud, the builder of the modern Saudi state. The pilgrimage tax was the single most important source of his revenue. He told his British advisor, Harry St. John Filby, that, quote, if somebody came and offered me £1 million, I would give them the concession to anything they wanted in my kingdom. Now, luckily for Abdulaziz, Standard Oil Company of California came along shortly thereafter and did just about that for him. But my point here is that the Gulf and the Peninsula economies were extremely dependent on global economic trends for their meager surpluses. We're not talking about huge surpluses, but the percentage of that surplus that was generated through what we would today call globalization was enormous. And that was true even before oil. Now, of course, when the oil industry comes to the region, it brought huge amounts of foreign direct investment. It tied the region into global trade patterns at a much higher level in terms of dollar amounts and in terms of the effects on the local economies. And it promoted what became massive population movements across regional lines. FDI, trade, population movements. Right? This pretty much defines, in large part, economic globalization. And that is what oil brought to the region. Economic integration became much more extensive, right, affecting the lives and the life chances of the vast majority of people in the Gulf and the Arabian Peninsula over the decades, for good and for ill. I think it's also important to note that in the early oil decades, right, when oil became the dominant force in the regional economies in the post-World War II era, in these early decades of the 40s, late 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, as surrounding states like Egypt and Turkey and Iraq were deglobalizing through socialist and import substitution industrialization policies, it's important to note that the Gulf oil states maintained the principle of privatization of profits. And they nurtured, though with a somewhat heavy hand and for a political price, they nurtured their own private sectors. And they were much more open to the world in terms of trade, investment, and finance. While most of this region, right, was deglobalizing in the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s, the Gulf states were not. And thus the Gulf states were, as Professor Luciani has pointed out in other works, and I'm probably stealing some of his thunder right now, the Gulf states were better prepared to take advantage of the opportunities that globalization presented in the last few decades, because their private sectors had a longer history of development and a longer uninterrupted history of activity. Interestingly enough, when we talk about oil and how oil has integrated this region into the world economy, in the first decades of the oil revolution, the 1970s and the 1980s, the economic fortunes of the Gulf states, while tied very closely to the world economy and to the world oil economy, seemed to vary inversely with more global economic trends. The oil riches of the 1970s came at a time when the global economy generally was in recession. And of course, there is a relationship between those two factors. Conversely, the local economies saw periods of stagnation in the mid-1980s and the late 1990s when oil prices fell. Yet these periods were at times of great global boom, the mid-1980s and the late 1990s. One of the interesting changes, I think, in this most recent economic crisis is that it corresponds with a steep decline in the price of oil. And I think this is a new phenomenon. Whereas previously, world economic trends and the price of oil seemed to have an inverse relationship, or at best a lagged relationship, now it seems that the world economy and the local oil economy and the global oil economy are now more synchronized than they've been in past decades. Right? And I think that there are two reasons for this. First, with the world economy so strongly tied together, a recession in the United States means a global recession, with oil demand declining simultaneously around the world. Right, the hope that China and India and Europe could act as an engine to pull the United States out of its economic slump has proved to be a chimera. The world goes up and down together, and so will demand for oil. OPEC might be able to affect the prices at the margins if it can maintain quota discipline, but the bedrock fundamental of global oil demand is being driven by a global economy that moves, it seems now, in one direction at a time. And while that can be very positive for the local economies when the world economy is going up, it's very negative for the local economies when the world economy is going down, and producers have very little opportunity to flatten out this boom-bust cycle. In that sense, the Gulf economies, just as they were during the pearling days, are tied to economic forces over which they have, in some cases, no control in a small state like Kuwait, in other cases like Saudi Arabia, have only the minimal kind of influence over. Now, if that were not enough, another aspect of globalization in the last few decades exacerbates the fluctuations driven by global economic growth and decline. The internationalization of finance has turned oil contracts into another paper commodity for speculators to buy and sell. The enormous run-up in prices in the first half of 2008 to above $140 per barrel, followed by the fall of more than $100 per barrel in a matter of months, cannot be attributed to changes in supply and demand. The world did not change that much in so short a time. Rather, the oil futures market had become a way station for the trillions of dollars sloshing around in the global financial system. The market was driven by people who had no desire to ever possess a cargo of oil. When the bubble burst, these speculators fled the oil market and prices collapsed. So while oil has certainly integrated the Gulf economies into the world economy in a much more extensive way than before, it's just recently, I think, that the oil economy and the world economy have become more synchronous, right? Have moved together, booming together and busting together. A final point. I don't think that the enormous interest by outside powers in the Gulf region can be attributed to recent trends in globalization and the world oil market. The Portuguese were building forts in this region in the 1500s. And Britain made the Gulf into its own lake well before the oil era began. America is just the most recent world power to want to dominate the region. The reasons might change, but the pattern remains the same. Also, despite the enormous changes that oil wealth has brought to the region, it's interesting to note that the political regimes on the Arab side of the Gulf have remained remarkably stable at the top throughout this process of deeper integration into the world economy. Right, now, globalization means change. But in terms of great power patterns, and in terms of the domestic political regime types here on the Arab side of the Gulf, the period of globalization has not led to that much change. Right. We see a stable pattern of great power interest, influence, and intervention into the region. And we see a remarkable stability at the top. I don't want to say that politics in this part of the world and on the Arab side of the Gulf hasn't changed. It has. It's changed demographically. It's changed at the social base. But regime type has been remarkably, and I think anyone who had started looking at this region at the beginning of the globalization phenomenon in the 70s and 80s, you would have found very few people saying, well, one thing that won't change is the political regime types on the Arab side of the Gulf. I think it's been quite remarkable. These consistencies have been quite remarkable, despite the enormous changes that we've seen
at the global level.
So what has globalization done besides make people on this in this part of the world richer, right? And improved, I think, their daily lives, right? There's a tendency, I think, among intellectuals in the Gulf to decry some of the effects of oil in terms of the work ethic, in terms of cultural influences. And I appreciate that. But I think at the same time we have to recognize that the life chances of people in this part of the world and the experience of their daily life is vastly improved because of this money. I ask you just to contemplate the phenomenon of air conditioning in this part of the world. Right? Living in this part of the world, those of you who live here know, when it gets hot can be a very uncomfortable thing. And one of the things that the wealth of oil money has brought is extensive air conditioning. And while we can decry cultural changes and loss of work ethic and things like that, it's a lot easier to do that in an air-conditioned room than in an un-air-conditioned room. But there have been interesting changes, I think. One of the things that I've noted being here this past few months is that the nature of the political debate in Kuwait is not much different from the nature of the political debate in the United States right now. Right? In the United States, right, we have a government that's trying to put forward, successfully put forward, a stimulus plan through its legislature that inspired an enormous amount of debate about who's going to benefit from this. The big guys, right? The big guys, the bankers, all these people are going to benefit, whereas the little person doesn't get anything. Right? I found that that's exactly the nature of the political debate here in Kuwait. In fact, I learned some new Arabic words when I came. Haitan is the sharks and Zarazir is the little birds. Right? And that's exactly, when I email my friends back home, I say, well, how are the sharks doing and are the little birds getting any bits of the stimulus package? Right? It's interesting that in the globalization of the world financial crisis, we see replicated in the United States and Kuwait almost the exact political debate. I don't know what conclusions to draw from that, but I find it interesting. The second political change that I think we can attribute to globalization, this really is the last thing I'm going to say, is the increased global attention to the domestic political and social practices of the states of this region. Right? Again, this is not completely new, right? Anti-slavery groups in Britain in the 19th century affected what was part of the regional trade here in the Gulf, the slave trade, and closed it down in the 19th century. But there's a new global attention through non-governmental organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and labor organizations, and through international governmental organizations like the ILO, the International Labor Organization, and international financial regulators, there's a new interest with how the Gulf states deal with their own domestic politics, whether it be women's issues, political rights, migrant labor rights, financial systems. The pressures on Gulf governments to adopt international standards in an array of areas is, I think, a somewhat new phenomenon in the region that stems directly from the larger set of challenges that we call globalization. Thank you.
Thank you. Greg and I have known each other for a long time, and evidently we have developed some kind of symbiosis, because what he just said beautifully prepares what I am going to say and show to you, assuming that I can get this computer started, which... it's coming up, yes. Swipe finger to log on. Is this? Administration logged. Thank you, Adnan. Okay. So I have a few slides primarily to help myself in following the line of reasoning. I was asked to discuss Gulf business and globalization, and we really are speaking about two terms, both Gulf business and globalization, that are in a process of rapid change, and so we are targeting really a moving target, and I hope that you will bear with me for some sweeping generalizations that I will propose to you. I feel a bit ill at ease as an economist to propose such sweeping generalizations, but in times of crisis as we are, you need to make an effort to fly high and see major transformations. Inevitably, this involves a considerable degree of subjectivity. Okay, we do this manually. First of all, as Gregory already has said, I think we have to start from the statement that the Gulf is a global region, and that there is it's in the DNA of this region to be involved with global trends. It's a region that has always structurally been open to international trade. And even before the advent of oil, the Gulf economy, the economy in this part of the world, has been based on long-distance trade, on long-distance movements of people, in the case of the Hajj, of merchandise, and on financial relations with the outside world, primarily the Indian subcontinent, but even more widely than that. In the oil age, this specific character of the Gulf has been even reinforced, because the Gulf has become the marginal provider of oil for the whole world. So whatever happens in the Gulf in terms of hydrocarbons, oil and gas, is relevant for the entire world, and the region has attracted the attention of everybody in the world. So it's an intrinsically global region. As such, the Gulf never has been tempted by autarky as an option, as a strategic option, differently from other Arab countries, differently from other emerging countries. The Gulf has always had an open economy, open to international trade, open to international capital movements, and therefore has had a posture that has been more favorable to the process of globalization, as has been mentioned. And in fact, I would say that the Gulf needs globalization, and if by any chance, as I will say later on, globalization were to be reversed, the Gulf would obviously suffer. Before 2008 clearly marks a dividing line for the globalization process. So I will divide my comments in an analysis of what globalization has been before 2008, and how Gulf business has participated in that before 2008, and what is happening under our eyes now. Before 2008, globalization has gone through several phases. These phases should not be understood as being rigidly divided time period. They have overlapped, but we can distinguish several phases. The first phase has been characterized by decreasing barriers to international trade. This has begun already soon after the Second World War. It's a process that has been going on for the best part of 60 years, and it is perhaps the most fundamental process behind globalization. But there has been also a second phase characterized by the advent of multinational corporations and foreign direct investment, which has known perhaps its peak in the 1970s and 80s, and has somewhat declined thereafter, and being substituted by a third phase in which finance and the hegemony of finance over industry has been the characterizing feature of globalization. Industry has been the protagonist of the phase of multinational corporations, but has lost out to financial integration and financial globalization thereafter. this globalization process has been driven by certain key drivers, and we have to say that so far global growth and the process of globalization have been driven primarily by demand growth in the industrial countries. This has been the key driver. So we have had, especially in the United States, consumer demands increasing systematically with negative savings. The U.S. Consumer sector has been accumulating debts beyond their probably financial capabilities. At the same time, the government, the U.S. government, has been accumulating deficits, especially in the last during the last administration of George W. Bush. And the United States as a country has registered continuing and indeed increasing trade deficit, which were financed by capital inflow from the rest of the world. This has been a well understood mechanism for a long time under our eyes, and I think it's unquestionable. In that sense, globalization has meant what? It has meant that the developing countries have been investing in the industrial countries. Now, this may not seem and is not probably in the long run the ideal posture and the ideal result. Okay? There have been enablers, phenomena that have allowed this process to take place. And first of all, I would mention the fact that the industrial countries, at least some of them, others have been more reluctant, but some of the major industrial countries, notably the United States and the United Kingdom, have accepted a process of deindustrialization. They have embraced this process. They have not resisted it. France has resisted it to some extent. Germany has resisted it to some extent. Not entirely, but there has been some resistance. But the United States and the United Kingdom have not resisted. They have accepted to become deindustrialized in the conviction that they could survive on selling services, that services would be enough to guarantee their position in the international economy. At the same time, we have had globally a process of industrial growth which has been essentially made possible by abundant supply of cheap labor. In that respect, it has been nothing new with respect to past experiences of fast growth or so-called economic miracles. It is always the abundant supply of labor or infinite supply of labor, a la William Arthur Lewis, that is at work. Countries that have huge reservoirs of underemployed labor, especially in agriculture, can mobilize it and start a process of fast industrial growth. This is why China, this is why India, this is why not Russia, because Russia does not have a large supply of underutilized labor. It's a country that is registering a decline in population and, as a matter of fact, a worsening in life expectancy for specifically Russian conditions. This process of global industrial growth has been financed by the very high rate of savings in certain countries, notably in Asia. We have had an extraordinarily high rate of savings in this country, which has allowed at the same time the financing of industrial growth and the financing ultimately of the U.S. Trade deficit and the industrial countries' trade deficit. We have had contradictions in this process, contradictions that we have been aware of for a long time, for a long time. There is nothing, there has been no surprise, but they have not been addressed. It was known for a long time, it has been known for a long time, that this pattern could not continue forever, and at some point this equilibrium needed to be adjusted. And the IMF and all economic analysts have been saying so for a long time, for years. It was hoped that the landing, the transition, the adjustment could be soft and that and gradual, and that the global economy would not too much suffer. in retrospect, we may ask ourselves on what basis this hope was grounded, because there was no mechanism at all guaranteeing that the landing would be soft and that the process of adjustment would be progressive. And yet, you know, there was this optimism. But we now know that the landing has been a crash landing, the adjustment has been brutal, and we have a global recession, a global crisis, showing, in a sense, the success of globalization. No one is indemned from the crisis. No country can isolate itself from the global context, and we are all in the same boat, I believe, more so than it has ever been the case. In this first phase of globalization that has just concluded, Gulf business has participated actively. By Gulf business, I mean the Gulf private sector, Gulf private investors, primarily has participated as a way to diversify assets and diversify investment. Confronted with a set of relatively limited opportunities in the domestic economy, the Gulf private sector has largely invested internationally in financial assets or in real estate, and this investment has taken place primarily in the industrial countries. Not exclusively. Indeed, in the last few years, there has been growing interest for emerging economies, readiness to take significant risks. But by and large, I think if we had exhaustive and credible statistics, which we don't have, we would see that the bulk of investment from this part of the world has gone into the industrial countries in the United States, in Europe, to a lesser extent in Japan. We have had some exceptions. Some large state-owned entities have engaged in strategic investment, that is, in a process of globalization. Kuwait Oil Company was early on in this process. Dubai Ports is a late example. SABIC is known to everybody. So there have been a few distinguished and important enterprises, state-owned, either majority or entirely, that have engaged in international acquisitions in order to acquire a global dimension. In a few cases, smaller and privately owned entities also have engaged in direct investment in recent years. But relatively speaking, I believe we can conclude that the Gulf enterprises have engaged in this kind of activity less than their counterparts in India, in Brazil, in Russia, in Argentina. Many of the major deals have been concluded by privately owned companies in these other emerging countries rather than by Gulf investors. So now we are at the beginning of a new phase of globalization, full of uncertainties, and we can ask ourselves what will drive the next phase of globalization. What we have seen so far is basically, in one way or another, creation of liquidity, attempts to revive lending and consumer demand in the United States. Europe has not quite followed along the same lines. European governments have been more cautious. They are more afraid of creating an inflationary overhang. But I believe, I'm one of those who believes that this had just stopgap measures. Confronted with the gravity of the crisis, that's probably the only thing you can do, but it does not open a window towards possibility for long-term growth and revival. So, why is that the case? Because if and when the situation improves, which might be sooner or later, maybe hopefully soon, but we will immediately be confronted with a problem of inflation, and disequilibria again will come to the fore, and they will need to be adjusted, not financed. They cannot be financed forever. We face a protectionist danger. I have an office one block away from the WTO, and I can tell you people are concerned, very much concerned about the future of international trade. I receive appeals and messages in my email about the worrisome state of international trade almost daily. People are concerned. We are moving in the direction of creeping protectionism, and there is a danger. There is a danger that the process of globalization might come undone. And that is a major danger for the Gulf, I believe, because exactly Gulf business is especially dependent on a continuation of the process of globalization. And so this is something that you should look at very carefully in this region, I believe. We must also, at the same time, establish the basis for a lasting recovery, and I believe that this can only come from increased investment in the emerging economies, the Chinas, the Indias, the Brazils, including, of course, the Gulf. But it is also necessary to widen the base of this growth, and involve in it regions and economies that have not yet participated in it, that are not yet emerging. And I mean specifically some of the other economies, some of the other Arab economies, your neighbors that for one reason or another have not yet participated in the process of globalization. Your neighbor to the north is a clear example of that, of a country that needs to be energized and hopefully finally find the political conditions for it to participate actively in the process of globalization. And there is also, I would like to mention, sub-Saharan Africa, which is the big missing continent in the process of globalization, where Gulf business has in recent times invested very heavily and demonstrated a willingness to take risks and think ahead, which I think needs to be recognized and will give the Gulf business a major role in the future. I'm pretty sure of that. This is a time when we need the Gulf business needs to be ready to seize opportunities. There will be opportunities. There will be opportunities because I believe a redistribution of assets is inevitable, and it will appear as a set of opportunities in the coming months and years. Increasingly, we will see industrial and financial enterprises, manufacturing companies, banks, that will seek new investors to provide the risk capital which they need to continue in their growth or simply survive. And we'll need new investors to open doors to new markets because their traditional markets are not any longer sufficiently dynamic. So this is a time when you must be ready to seize opportunities, and it is my impression that still today Gulf business is not sufficiently prepared to take advantage of emerging opportunities. There are structural problems that prevent Gulf business from taking full advantage of the opportunities. You need to breed champions in this context, and I believe the problem is that Gulf business remains excessively fragmented, and the individual business groups that are characteristics of this region are frequently spread over too many lines of business, too diversified, not sufficiently focused, and therefore unable to pursue a strategy of globalization that is made possible by the opportunities that are emerging at this time. So we need a reorganization process that allows for the emergence, not the emergence, of regional champions of global significance. We need to have more golf champions in numerous industries in which they can emerge out of the combination and retooling of existing excessively diversified and fragmented interests. We need in this context to speed up the GCC economic, financial and monetary integration. I think this is number one priority at the moment in this region, and I have always been convinced that the project of monetary integration is a necessity and it will eventually succeed. We witness a new change in the balance between business and the state, between private sector and the state, because the crisis has affected Gulf private investors. This has been inevitable. Nobody has been exempted from suffering because of the crisis. And has affected the private investors more so than the state. So after a period of time in which the state appeared to lose some ground to the balance, to the private sector, and the private sector acquired greater resources than the state, roughly the period from late 80s to early 2000, we now have a period in which resources have again shifted in favor of the state and the private sector has suffered. True, the price of oil has declined, and this is not acting in favor of the state, but I believe that the losses of the private sector are worse than the, I believe, temporary decline in the price of oil. The problem is that if resources are in the hands of the state can channel these resources easily towards state-owned entities, but state-owned entities cannot successfully participate in the globalization process. This is, if you wish, the story of Dubai ports. There was an objection to its globalization process because it is a state-owned entity. So we need to think in terms of the challenge for the Gulf economies is how to engineer a transfer of resources from the state to to privately owned globalizing entities. And this requires new and imaginative policies. I am not convinced that a pure and simple bailout of the private sector on the part of the state, you know, just simply showering money around the way Bernanke has been theorizing, is the solution. I think the two processes, the reorganization of corporate entities and the transfer of resources, have to take place at the same time. If you just have a bailout, a showering of liquidity onto the private sector, you fail the opportunity to achieve a restructuring, and you do not breed the champions that you need to pursue the new phase of globalization. Thank you.
This doesn't work anyhow, so you will...
I see. Plug away.
Yes.
Good morning, everybody.
Hello.
That's the last one. And the Hutton, I think you got. We want this one, yeah? And then, what we go full screen.
Okay, well, this is yours?
Yeah.
Okay.
And full screen?
Display.
Display. Okay. Well then.
Okay.
Thank you. I've, good morning. I'm just going to say a few words some of these, rather like Giacomo, these are slides which support my kind of line of argument, and as much for kind of an aid memoir for myself, and where they overlap with the previous speakers, I'll skip through them quite quickly. what I want to do in just a few minutes is to look at the structure of globalization, kind of unpack the credit crunch, try and assess whether really this is a depression that is it as bad as the Great Depression in the 1930s? Is it worse? There are those who argue that the circumstances globally are the worst they've been for 125 years. And certainly the stock markets, as I'll show, are anticipating that things are as bad. You can buy British shares at the moment more cheaply than you could in October 1940. In other words, the stock market is saying that the risks to British capitalism are greater than they were before a German invasion. You can buy American shares as cheaply, there's only two or three times in the last 120 years when you could buy American shares so cheaply. So markets are clearly telling us something. Question, are they right? Adair Turner did a review of regulatory structures in Britain. He has a very interesting picture of credit default swap rates in the months before, in May 2007. Well, credit default swap rates were the lowest they'd been, actually, signalling that the financial system was in absolutely rude health. And had you followed that market signal, you'd have said, all is fine. Maybe the market signal that's being sent now, which is that we are facing a Great Depression, is as wise as the one 2 years ago, which told us that the sky was blue. And I'm going to be slightly contrarian and say that while things are very, very, very severe, I think there are signs, given the amazing policy response, that we'll get through this. It'll be a very severe 2-year recession rather than a decade-long period of economic global stagnation. I'm going to try and point out some of the things that may stimulate recovery, and I conclude with what I think are some quite interesting challenges to the Gulf states. So let's get on with it. Having told you what I'm going to say, I'll now tell you it. Globalization. I don't want to spend too much time on this. This has been done by the other speakers very effectively, and I very much like the notion that there was a kind of a the globalization has happened in a sequence. As far as the Gulf states are concerned, I mean, it's plain that globalization means trade, and that's meant that your oil underneath the sand here is worth very much more, and it's also clear that it goes up and down cyclically in value. It's also actually empowered states with tax revenue they wouldn't otherwise have had. A big question about state capacity in the GCC countries. And actually choices about whether you spend your money on hard infrastructure or soft infrastructure. And there are some subtle differences and not so subtle differences among the GCC states. Obviously, it's thrown up... Oh, okay, that's lovely, yeah, okay. I can point things on this, can I? Uh-huh, let's see if that works. Does this work? Oh, I see. Perfect. What a. Oh, look, that's fantastic. Really enjoy this. I'm gonna have such a great presentation. A lot of fun. I think it's evident that without globalization, the Gulf would not look as it does. And rather than repeat what others have said, I'll just move on. Although I do think it's worth noting that it has thrown up, and here I think the kind of last point needs to be said. I mean, there are in all Western states, and I think in GCC states, you know, fundamental issues about income distribution, wealth distribution, and actually tensions between old and new, very evident in this region. So there we are, we're cruising along, it's 2007, globalization is working for the Gulf and throwing up lots of opportunity and throwing up challenges. Then the credit crunch. It's worth noting, and here I take a slightly
contrarian view. And there's a view that and because the credit crunch originated in America, it was all down to their very low savings, and that had the Americans saved more and had their banks relied less on the American to bank market, there wouldn't have been quite such a problem. Actually, there was a world savings glut. The Americans were the spenders of last resort. And whether it was the $2 trillion worth of foreign exchange reserves built up in China over the decade up to 2007, or the $2 trillion, close to $2 trillion held here, or the $2 trillion in Japan, or the $1 trillion in the rest of Asia, that money had to go somewhere. And the Americans could, of course, refuse it by running their economy at much lower levels of output and employment and growth. And I don't think the rest of the world would have liked it very much, because export growth into the United States would have been very much lower. The Chinese certainly would not have liked it. So there is a certain, I mean, although there's a sense when we talk about global imbalances to blame the damn Americans because they dared to have low savings, you can equally well blame the rest of the world for having very high savings. And of course, one of the culprits, if you look at the world in that way, is of course the Gulf States. That money was intermediated via the interbank markets into extraordinary growth in bank balance sheets. Bank lending grew for the 10 years up to 2007 at twice the rate of growth of money GDP in countries like America and Britain. Really astonishing growth. And when you throw a lot of money at banks, they will invent instruments to get the money away, if you like. Hence those extraordinary instruments that which we've come to know so well. The notion that you could insure the risk through the default swap market. The incentive structure has been talked about a lot. No need to repeat that. We get to the summer of 2007 and back Barry Parr and Bear Stearns of a couple of hedge funds, which actually have to close because they can't. There's not enough cash to meet the investors' redemptions. A storm warning of a great unwinding of an extraordinarily overstretched world financial system. Everyone in the room knows the story. There's been the catastrophic write-downs in the United States alone, in excess of $1 trillion. Close to another $1 trillion in the rest of the world, more to come, and the seizure of the interbank market. And the one of the interesting things, I think, was that that took place in the decade to 2007 was that bankers and actually the world at large rather took the view that a deep, broad interbank market in the major states and financial centres in the world, including, of course, Dubai, was like the sea, and Kuwait was like the sea. It would never, ever go out. The tide would always be in. You could, as a bank, finance yourself and some banks by 2007, they had two-thirds or more of their liabilities were in the interbank market. Only a third was retail deposits. And then they were leveraged on top. Some of the American investment banks were refinancing their entire liability structure, a quarter of it, every single day in 2007, on top of which they had leverage of 35 to 40 times capital. I mean, an astonishing financial structure, which was set to implode as it has done. We've watched the banks have retreated to national lending. International lending has fallen away calamitously. It's become increasingly hard to finance orthodox trade. A lot of cargo that would have moved between country A and country B or around Asia has been just not financeable, and that's added to the problems of destocking as businesses and retailers actually unable, facing a secular fall away in demand, are not placing orders again with factories. That's led to an amazing fall in industrial production. In Japan, the fall in industrial production in the last 3 months is a third. The fall in UK car production in February was down 59% on February 08. These are astonishing and breathtaking numbers. We will see the IMF reports the first decline in world GDP since 2009, and the World Trade Organization now forecasts a 9% fall away in trade in 2009. That's actually the biggest fall in trade growth since 1945. And here's one of the big points. 18 months ago, the Asians were proudly boasting that they would get through. This was a Western problem. It was a problem minted in America through its excessive consumption and low savings. To a lesser extent, the Europeans and the Asians would get through it trouble-free. Indeed, they might even become a motor of the rest of the world economy. A profound piece of economic arrogance and a profound misunderstanding of Asia's relationship to the rest of the world. Asia is essentially a subcontractor to the industrialized West, and China is the subcontractor in chief. Two-thirds of Chinese exports are made by foreign companies located in China and supplying Western markets. Look at the pattern of imports and exports in China. Of course, their exports have fallen precipitately over the last 3 months, but so have their imports, because many of their imports are being reprocessed to be re-exported. And Asia's difficulties are now as severe, or even, I'm going to argue, more severe than those of the industrialized West. Now, here's the point where I start to kind of differ from the consensus. And some of you will know that I was really quite bearish about the markets, and bearish and very keenly aware of the non-sustainability of kind of financially driven globalization in the 5 years up to 2007. There has been the most extraordinary policy response. Quantitative easing in the States alone, announced last week, of $1.2 trillion, the Fed buying government debt, corporate bonds, and of course mortgage-backed securitized assets, and extraordinary, on top of zero interest rates, on top of a budget deficit that will be 14% of GDP in calendar 2009, on top of George Bush's troubled asset relief program, the TARP. I mean, these are extraordinary. And then we learnt on Monday, Tim Geithner's rescue plan, depending very heavily on taking money from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and leveraging it. Actually, fun enough, it was a kind of public sector version of some of the private sector leverage that we've seen. But to buy legacy toxic assets. In fact, you can't use the word toxic in the States anymore. You can use legacy assets or problem assets, so the terminology for these loans that are worth some fraction of what their nominal value was when they were first lent. And it is, as a policy response, it puts anything since 1945 in the shade. And the UK response has also been very, very extraordinary. The British have been prepared to take stakes in their banks to an extent which the Americans have shied away from. And we've gone for an asset protection scheme rather than the rather tortured scheme that Tim Geithner and President Obama have devised. In many respects, the British approach, I think, is more readily understandable and more likely to go right. There's a lot of risks attendant to what the Americans are supposing. If they don't get the private investors, or they can't actually crystallize the prices of these assets, they're in some trouble, and they will have to find themselves recapitalizing their banks. So you've got two very extraordinary policy responses in Britain and America. And frankly, given actually their culture and their approach to this, fairly extraordinary policy responses in Europe and Japan. And again, I take a slightly contrarian view. I've been a kind of economic journalist and commentator for more than 30 years, and I've been writing up banal communiques from G7 and G8 summits, and it's not kind of having to write about it, certainly reading them. But the approach to this G20 summit on April the 2nd, I think, is rather amazing. Not a conventional view, you won't hear it from many people, but I think if 24 months ago you'd have said that the world will commit to a more than doubling of the IMF's resources, I think you'd have asked, what have you been smoking? If over and above that you said that actually the Japanese, the Europeans, the Americans and the British, and actually the Chinese, Indians, Russians and Brazilians and the rest of G20 will coalesce around an increasingly common approach to regulating financial institutions, you'd have said, what have you been smoking? Some of the challenges to credit rating agencies and their regulation, I think, is also kind of long overdue and important. I even think we might get some common position on bank remuneration, let alone commitments that are slightly more anodyne and hard to pin down and are often observed more in the breach than the observance, on actually completing the Doha round on trade protection. But there will certainly be a recommitment along a common template to stand behind the banking systems and to create, I think, good banks where possible. So, you know, for me, and then the most extraordinary thing of all, I think the perhaps over and above Obama's fiscal stimulus and over and above Tim Geithner's bank rescue plan, I think the governor of the Central Bank of China saying, posting on the bank website a big article arguing that the time had come for the dollar to lose its reserve currency status and to be replaced by reformed SDRs was, you know, a big challenge to to the notion that the dollar is going to remain a kind of anchor reserve currency. This is very, very important, though, for the point that other speakers made about what's going to happen to the countries on the economic periphery. I think the Chinese won't, of course, get that, but what the Chinese will get from the G20 is a commitment that less developed countries can use SDR facilities much more aggressively and extensively than they have hitherto. Again, really, really important for the economic periphery. And if you'd said 18 months ago that a G20 meeting would come up with so many concrete steps, maybe not as much as someone like me would really like to see, but so many concrete steps, you wouldn't have dreamt it. I mean, this is a world in which nothing changes, nothing happens, everything is banal, and you move at the pace of the slowest caravan in the chain. So the combination of these extraordinary national policy responses and this extraordinary international policy response gives me some grounds to believe that we're not actually going to have a decade of economic stagnation. I think we're going to go through an extraordinarily grim 2 years, but that by the end of this year there will be the first signs of things stabilising in the States, and next year things stabilising in Europe, and then afterwards Asia. And there are first signs, actually, that the US property market, that the rate of decline of US property prices is slowing down, and there's some sign also that the rate of inquiry into and turnover in the US property market is beginning to stabilise and indeed pick up. And the British and the Americans, and indeed the Europeans, have demonstrated, and the Japanese, that actually they will print money. They can use the power of the state to stand behind their financial systems and print money, and they will. And so my view is that we're going through a sets it out really broadly, my view of where I think the economy is likely to go, and I think we'll start to see some genuine increase in oil prices probably in about 18 months to 2 years' time. So for Gulf states, the planning must be done on the basis that the oil price will be at around this level or fractionally lower for another 2 years before actually seeing a recovery in the price. But stories about that we're in for a much, much longer period of quasi-depression seems to me to be, you know, flying in the face of what the policy response has been. Now, I'm not saying that everything in the garden is going to be lovely. I mean, it's obvious that the Western financial sector remains profoundly weak. It's obvious that the business model that many Western financial banks have adopted, particularly in the so-called secondary or shadow financial market, with trading in proprietary trading desks and dealing in enormous books of derivatives, that all that is, for a period, going to go away. And I think one of the pushes actually for globalization have been American investment banks and the great US Citigroup, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley were some of the and in their slipstream, UBS, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank. These are the big drivers of and financial globalization. And I mean, what has happened, and it has to be said again, is catastrophic, that the five American investment banks are no more, and that two of them are trading as banks, is an extraordinary state of affairs. The weakness of Citigroup, which was riding such a dominant international financial house just 5 years back, what's happened to it, it's humbling, it's extraordinary. Let alone what's happened actually to some European banks like Royal Bank of Scotland. I mean, Royal Bank of Scotland and HBOS, which were two very significant banks, both in the global top 10 in 1999, bust. And Lloyds Bank, which was number 4 in the global top 10 in 1999, in 2009 is now number 53. Some of the and the top, of course, and the top banks, if you believe the numbers, the top three banks are all Chinese. The change in the pecking order in the in the international financial system is extraordinary. So what I'm saying about the next period ahead is acknowledging the dangers of local protectionism, acknowledging actually, I thought it was quite worrying that the kind of Swiss willingness to kind of devalue the Swiss franc, although for a Brit skiing in Switzerland last week, Switzerland didn't seem very cheap to me, notwithstanding their devaluation. One point that is that David Held said in his introduction was that I am much more cautious than the consensus about China. The growth in 2000 and in Canada 2007 was close to, I'm not sure about the numbers, but in the area 11 or 12%. And the World Bank now thinks that the growth in China in 2009 will be the order of 6.5 to 8. Although again, there's always a slight degree of approximation about Chinese numbers, but broadly growth has halved in calendar 2009 compared with 2007. Now, a lot's been said about the Western banking system, but a halving in the growth rate modelled by the World Bank and by independent modellers has a pretty disastrous impact on Chinese bank balance sheets, because so many of the loans that are on the bank balance sheets will become non-performing in those circumstances. I mean, the World Bank did an exercise in 2007 in which it modelled the impact of the kind of fall away in the growth rate we've seen, and it suggested that as between 40 to 70% of the $2 trillion worth of loans made by Chinese banks to state enterprises would become non-performing. In other words, the Chinese have their own subprime structured investment vehicle and collateralized debt obligation problem. It's loans to state-owned enterprises in a period of stagnating growth in Chinese terms. For them, growth of that type is very low. Between 1949 and 1976, Chinese growth averaged 4.6%. Even in the Mao years, China's growth was running at around 4.5%, 5%. So for growth to come back to 6.5% is profoundly disappointing for the Chinese. Their exports have gone negative year on year. But as many as 20 million, it's estimated, migrant workers who returned actually to their villages in the Chinese New Year have not gone back to the cities from which they came. China is the risk of social instability, the risk of a big financial crisis is ever present. And you know, the notion that it will sell through the next period is untouched is, I think, unlikely. And also beware of great tension between the Americans and the Chinese. Now, I wanted us to put this up because I wanted to show you where the stock market is currently at. These numbers, this is the price earnings ratio you'll see. So from 1881 to 2008, and this was when the stock market was 15% higher than it currently is, that's now down there. So you can see, and these are earnings, this is a price earnings ratio for S&P shares, Standard & Poor's shares, in that basket of 500, S&P 500. And those earnings are, it's a 10-year moving average, cyclically adjusted. It's as clean as it can be. And you can see that that the shares were cheap in the last oil crisis, 79.80. You go back to 29, and you go back to the end of the First World War. That's there's been three occasions in the last 120 years when shares have been as cheap as they are at the moment. And my point is that given the extraordinary policy response in the States, in the G20, in the EU and the UK, that I think the markets everything is in there for catastrophic write-downs. Everything is in there for the everything in the market is pricing catastrophic write-downs. It's pricing in, you know, a decade of stagnation or even depression. There's nothing in there for the potential response of global economies to what's being done. If this goes any cheaper, we might as well back and up and go home for 5 years. And for Gulf states, considering what they're going to do with their assets, I mean, there is for me a kind of clear and unambiguous message.
You take some strategic stakes in American companies. I just want to digress for a second about what is going to drive recovery in the next period.
Excuse me. Just use this mic. So you can move around.
I'm going to finish in a few minutes. So I'm going to be finished. I'll be gone.
Anyway,
thank you.
I'm going to talk about general purpose technologies and this phenomena of the knowledge economy. The knowledge economy, which my foundation, I wear two hats. I work with David Held and his colleagues at Institute of Global Governance, NSC, and I also executive vice chair of an organization, a think tank in Britain called the Work Foundation. We do a lot of work on knowledge economy. And this is what we're trying to describe is an economy in which approaching half of output and employment is associated with sectors that are where the technology is extraordinarily youthful, or is associated with what's called a general purpose technology. And that's linked with, and success knowledge economies are linked with, not just this technological driver from, if you like, the universities and the great corporations and the great laboratories, but actually having a critical mass of consumers and businesses who are rich enough to be able to experiment and use and adopt the new technologies. And this gives an enormous advantage to societies that are already quite rich. I just want to. This is just a fun for 30 seconds. General personologies like, for example, the wheel, or the three-masted sailing ship that was invented in the 1480s by the Spanish, or the internal combustion engine, are the great technologies that have driven wealth generation over the last millennia. And here's the point of this little kind of chart. You can see that there were only a few of them, seven of them, in the first 10,000 years of human existence. By the time you get to the last century, there were eight. And the expectation is in the next 100 years, there will be 12 to 16 general purpose technologies. Humankind are going to invent technologies like the net, like the internal combustion engine, like the computer, like the wheel. As evident as that, every 5 to 7 years in the decades ahead. That's going to be the driver of wealth generation. And here's my point. Then actually the economies and societies which are going to invent them are going to be ones which have the infrastructure, the university infrastructure, the corporate infrastructure, the capacity to kind of innovate, the capacity gives people space to experiment, the organizational slack you need to embed in places to get this kind, to get these kind of technologies invented. They're going to have to be proximate to consumers whilst these new technologies are played with and experimented with. And do you know where I think most of those technologies are going to be invented by? They're going to be invented by the United States, the Japanese, and the Europeans. Triadic patents are patents which are simultaneously lodged in the EU, the United States, and Japan. 34% of those triadic patents are lodged by American companies, 32% by European companies, 29% by Japanese companies, 0.1% by Chinese companies. I gave a talk in China 18 months ago, and I said I'm really optimistic. I think that China's coming power, and I think its share of world triadic patents will go up 10 times in the next 50 years. And that in 2060, China will be inventing 1% of the triadic patents in the world. And Professor Xi, who advises Hu Jintao, told me I was optimistic. So I think that the prospects in the next 10 years are for a little bit of growth, nothing like we saw in the 1997-2007 period, a little bit of growth. I think that the United States will fix its financial system, which was an enormous source of comparative disadvantage for it. It's not that the American American investment banking, American commercial banking, as it was configured in the last 15 years, was holding back American innovativeness. I think the Americans are going to fix their financial system, and it will start to support general wealth, genuine wealth generation, genuine innovativeness, and I think it will exploit their extraordinary hard and soft infrastructure, which allows them to get such a disproportionate amount of these general purpose technologies. And I think the gap between it and China will widen rather than narrow. I think that the Europeans will hold ground. I think in Asia it will become clear that Japan remains the real powerful player, because it holds the capacity for technological innovation which actually no one else in Asia has. So my conclusion for the Gulf is that actually in geopolitical terms you carry on investing in American assets. Given how cheap that stock market is, you shouldn't hesitate to buy stakes in. I wouldn't advise to buy majority stakes because of the protectionism and recoil you get from the American public when you do it. But 5, 10, or 15% stakes in the top 500 American companies are going to be very good investments in my view. I think you carry on supporting the dollar. I think you must invest in your own knowledge economy, because that is the story of the next 20 years. Support the G20 architecture. I think the commitment the Saudis have made to the IMF General Agreement to borrow, and as it tries to increase its resources, is completely correct. And I hope that Kuwait will chip in its appropriate amount. As I reflected on this, and I thought about the collapse of the Western banking model, I began to wonder, and I'd love to talk about this over lunch, whether Sharia banking is potentially a source of comparative advantage, maybe a kind of a single currency in this part of the world, and exploiting actually Sharia banking against the bust and banking models of the West could be a very, very important moment for Arab capitalism. So, thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you, speakers, for a highly informative morning, certainly with a fair degree of controversy and some interesting differences between the speakers themselves, with clear differences in terms of analysis and prospects and even advice, to the, not that you need gentlemen advice, but different certainly suggestions as to how the Gulf might respond to the current crisis and develop over the next 10 years. Some areas of significant overlap and some areas of significant differences. I would like the panel perhaps to spend a moment commenting on each other's contributions, but before I ask them to do that, perhaps at the very end, I would like to take as many questions as possible, perhaps in clusters of four or five, so the panel has an opportunity to hear from you, and then I will ask them to respond to that. So the floor is yours now, and please take advantage of it. Yes, there you are.
Yeah. Hello. My name is Raina Nivari. I work for Global Investment House, and my question is for the panel. As you mentioned, that the private sector is taking part in globalization, and the government sector is taking part in globalization through their sovereign wealth funds. So my question is, how is it beneficial to the region when we see transactions like Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund buying into Chrysler, for instance? How is this beneficial to the country? How is this beneficial to the infrastructure? And wouldn't it be better to invest in the region given the opportunities available here? Not to talk about, for instance, diversification, especially in a down market where it's very questionable.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, that's an issue that perhaps Will can pick up later on. Yes, gentlemen.
Yes. There was a talk about integration of the Gulf financials, and the Will talked about the consolidation of regional blocks. We're moving in the GCC towards the single currency. And I would like just the view from somebody. Are we ready for it? And is there an advocate of that? And if not, what should we do?
Okay, that was a question for you, Jacoba, later on. Yes, lay it back.
Munaf Seysouf from the National Offset Company. I didn't hear from any of the renowned speakers anything about a new financial order or architecture. We know the Bretton Woods institutions came after World War II, and now we have a massive crisis which is equivalent to a Third World War. So what about the international financial institutions? Are they still speaking the language that we can use, IMF, World Bank, and WTO? I think there's a big question mark, and we don't find a grand scheme, and maybe the language even we're speaking has been different, and it's, our analysis is redundant. The models we're using are going away. I didn't find a response that can help us shift towards finding solutions and our way. Thank you.
So that's a question for all the speakers, really. Very little in what you said about the prospects of a new international settlement for a new international financial architecture that would take account both of the resources needed and the, perhaps a change in the balance of representation in those institutions going forward. So perhaps you might build that into your comments later. Lots of questions. Yes, please.
You press the red button.
Keep it on.
The red button. Yeah.
One of the things that came across in all of the presentation is that the need for not just new architecture, but the need for some kind of stronger regulation to prevent the excesses of the previous architecture. And I think this is being acknowledged in the U.S. in particular, and the G20 has committed itself to it. And yet, when you listen to the presentations, and even you read some books before the crisis, this was not unanticipated. There were a lot of people who wrote about it, but it just simply because the party was good, nobody bothered about, you know, fixing what obviously was wrong with it. My concern, and I would like to address this to the panel in terms of what are the risks that, especially given the last speaker, relative optimism, which I share to some extent, that in 2 years probably we'll be out because of the massive amount of responses, synchronized responses that are being put together by the industrial countries and the major economies. Aren't there risks that once the party at a slower pace begins again, there will be no incentive or no desire to really to tamper with it again because of the symbiosis between the power and the people who benefit mostly from the party?
Okay, thank you very much. Barry Bizan, yeah.
There's been a lot of talk, Barry Bizan, sorry, LSE, been a lot of talk about printing money and a lot of talk about huge amounts of government debt, but no talk about inflation. And it seems to me that this first two more or less lead to the third. I'm just wondering if anybody's worried about that.
All right, that's five questions. I think I'll hold off on commenting on each other. Perhaps I could keep that to the very end. But perhaps you could give you an opportunity to be succinct in your responses so we can go back to the audience for further questions. Perhaps I'll take you in reverse order now. Will, do you want to start and then briefly?
On inflation, I mean, I kind of think, would we be so lucky? I mean, at the moment, the worry is disinflation. And I do think, I'm strongly of the belief that you can siphon cash out of banking systems like we put it in. So there's not time to develop that, but we can have quantitative tightening if we start to believe that actually on the monetary and financial side there are impetus to inflation. Debates about inflation could take the next day. I do agree, and there were two questions, one about the are the IMF and WTO talking the right language and are they fit for purpose? And another one was saying, well, it's all very well being relatively optimistic, but are we just trying to return to the status quo that we had? And I rather agree with those questions, and I do think that that the next phase of the debate, and it needs to start, I think, quite quickly, when the house is burning down, you've got to put the fire out before you start thinking about the new house you're going to build in its place. At the moment, we're in the business of actually putting the fire out. And I'm beginning to think that we can douse the flames. And I very much agree, we've now got to ask questions, fundamental questions about, well, what are banks for? What are investment banks for? I think we're going to return to a world of core business purpose. Rather than just saying the point of capitalist enterprise is just to make money, I think capitalist enterprise is going to ask hard questions about what actually core business purposes are. And I think it'll be a very, very healthy thing. I think it'll be a very healthy thing to devise systems of corporate governance and regulation around the systems of corporate governance that reinforce business purpose as being at the core of what a capitalist enterprise should be about. There's a lot more to be said, but I think I should allow the others to speak.
Okay.
Well, I think we have a degree of disagreement here in the panel on one basic issue, whether this is a crisis out of which you can exit simply by reflating the economy, pumping liquidity, the extraordinary measures that were mentioned, or it requires some kind of more substantial adjustment. I tend to believe that it requires some substantial adjustment, and exactly in the absence of more substantial adjustment, we will very soon see inflationary pressures. I fully agree with your preoccupation on inflation. I think we are building up a huge inflationary overhang, and this is what worries the Chinese governor of the central bank. This is what worries many Europeans that are refusing to follow along the lines of the UK and US government in the intensity of reflation. So, of course, if you believe that there is need for a structural readjustment, yes, I very much believe that there is need for stronger regulation and retooling of several markets as, I think Adnan, you have heard me many times saying that the oil market needs to be reorganized on along different lines. I see this being repeated by more important people than I am, including Ali Naimi and others. But they say that the market doesn't work well, and then they don't propose anything in terms of what we should change to make it work better. I think the time has come to start discussing, okay, so what do we do to make it work better? I think we need to move in the direction of a new system, a new financial order. The debate has begun. You know, the very fact that somebody is proposing that we should move away from the dollar as the main currency is a demonstration. But even earlier, I mean, the creation of the euro has been a step in this direction. People have been aware of this problem for a while. And I believe the creation of the common Gulf currency will also be a step in this direction. Are we ready for it? We're never ready for anything. I mean, if you wait for the time you are ready, you never get there. You have to move decisively and solve problems as they emerge along the road. And that's what needs to be done. And so I believe the region is absolutely in need for a common currency, and as a matter of fact, a currency that may, like the euro, has become the currency of many more countries than was initially expected. I think the Gulf common currency might become a broader regional currency.
Thank you, Greg.
I don't have anything useful to say about these more global issues, which about which I don't know anything. But let me just speak very briefly about the GCC single currency proposal, which, while I don't disagree with Giacomo's notion that it would be a good thing, I see real obstacles to its achievement. Because if we take it on the model of the GCC common market, the idea of a common external tariff, it seems to me that two things drove the formation or the policy decisions that created a common external tariff program in the GCC. First, there was a committed group of bureaucrats within the Gulf Cooperation Council institution and within some of the national governments in the GCC that worked this issue, and I think that those bureaucrats had an enormous role in bringing this forward. But I think even more importantly, there was an external actor, which was the EU, which was demanding that the GCC come with a common proposal for GCC-EU trade relations. I don't know if there's that outside actor that's going to push the GCC toward a single currency. I don't know if the logic of a single currency or the commitment of an important bureaucratic cadre trying to work it through is enough to overcome the stasis in the national governments and the specific interests of people in national governments and institutions in maintaining the current order. So just because something needs to happen doesn't necessarily mean that it will.
Thank you. There is time, I think, for another round of questions, and I'd certainly like to take them. So, gentlemen, there you have.
We heard Mr. Hutton speak to the inherent weaknesses in the Chinese banking system. Do you see this as posing a risk down the road in the recovery with all the exposure of U.S. companies and U.S. and Western economies to the Chinese market?
Mark Thatcher, yeah. The red one.
There we go. It's interesting that globalization was treated very much in macroeconomic terms and institutional architecture. Much less was said about popular opinion. If there's going to be a return of the state, then popular opinion is likely to become more important. And I wonder if you might make some comments about how countries can respond, particularly to the losers from globalization, both within countries and across countries. I mean, just to take the former, the banking crisis is going to cost ordinary people a great deal of money. How can policymakers respond to what is like to be high popular discontent?
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Zaid al-Ma'rifi from the LSE in London. This question is directed at Professor Gauze. You mentioned that the Gulf economies are somewhat synchronized to global ups and downs, and you said that they needed to ensure discipline in their quotas. What kind of systems do you suggest that they use to garner such discipline in their quotas, and are there any other economic examples from where OPEC countries can draw from? Thanks.
Thank you. Gentleman right at the back, yes.
I had an addition to the Chinese comment. I'd like to hear your comments about how the U.S. debt has been fueled by the Chinese in buying treasuries. I think they represent about 6% of current treasuries outstanding. That's almost more than all the mutual fund industry holdings of the treasury market. In addition, the 1997 deleveraging of Asia was seen as what the developing economies are going through right now. So what's your view on consensus that Asia will emerge out of this recession healthier and better than the developed markets?
Well, there's a real queue of people wanting to raise issues. I think I'll just keep taking a few more, because it's good to have your views. Yes. And contributions. I think we can probably go on till 12:45. Is anyone? Yeah, 12:45. So let's just press on, gentleman right at the corner there.
Neil Patrick, American University of Sharjah. I wonder if I might ask Giacomo to respond to Greg's comment in terms of the political constraints on the common currency. I noticed that Sir Howard Davis talked about a crisis as an opportunity. Is there a sense that this is focusing minds in terms of trying to move, if not in 2010, which seems unrealistic, but move in a reasonable period of time towards the common currency? Or are we perhaps talking about, to use that old phrase, a two-speed process, whereby Kuwait and Oman are outside, others that can agree on perhaps the currency to which it should be pegged can perhaps move in the first leg?
Okay, thank you.
Daniel Kay from National Bank of Kuwait. No one's yet mentioned what I think is one of the most important relationships between the Gulf and globalization, and that is the demographic makeup of the region and the flood of expatriates working in the Gulf region. Here in Kuwait, 66, or two-thirds of the population are expatriates. It's only in Oman and Saudi Arabia that nationals outweigh expatriates in terms of the demographic structure. So I wondered if the panel could comment on what challenges and opportunities they think that demographic structure might have for the Gulf and in relation to globalization as it proceeds.
Yeah, Hans Dries from the LSE. I just have one comment and one remark. First, on the global level, I think the crisis that people just don't look at is that the country saved so much because as a consequence of the Asian financial crisis, because it was clear if you don't have foreign exchange currencies, you ran into trouble quite quickly. The question of the IMF is, if we go back to the actual Bretton Woods, we don't need to reinvent Bretton Woods. We just need to look at the actual documents and what Bretton Woods should have done, which they digressed from further and further from the 1970s onwards. On specifically on the Gulf, the question is, no one actually looked at what Kuwait and the other countries have to face in terms of challenges ahead in the mid to the long term, which is climate change, for example, which no one addressed at the moment, which is a huge issue that if even the most optimistic forecasts about climate change become true, then the region has huge troubles ahead. And what your remarks were in terms of that?
Well, we're building up quite a small agenda here for you to comment on. Let's just roll on a little bit longer, because then I can give you 3 or 4 minutes each to summarise your views and respond to the questions. Yes.
Yes, just very briefly, on the single currency, one interesting issue for the Gulf is whether it could become the basis of the currency in which oil prices could be denominated. I should have said Rodney Wilson, Durham University. So the single currency, basically, would it be potentially a currency for oil pricing? And then secondly, just in terms of Gulf economic integration, I mean, one issue is, of course, labour markets here, which are, of course, as a previous questioner pointed out, dominated by foreign labour. Whether it would make labour markets more efficient if, in fact, there was potentially mobility of expatriate labour within the GCC, which isn't at the moment, even within even nationally, because of the way the system works. And how, you know, whether there's any, you know, what are the political problems confronting that?
Thank you. I think demand is almost exhausted. Anyone else? Last chance, going. Yes, lady over there. Two more people, then we'll go back to the speakers.
Hello. I had a question. Sorry, my name is Dana, and I was a student at the LSC. I have a question about the comment made about avoiding Asian temptations. Now, wouldn't avoiding Asian temptations limit the Gulf's prospects of globalization? Thank you.
And finally, yes.
This is in response to the question before, and I want to put it to the panel. If you believe that there would be a tipping point in terms of the proportion of expatriate vis-a-vis technology that could almost do the same thing but at a higher cost, and currently the reason we're going with expatriate is that it's more cheap and the labor flow is coming in. But would there be a tipping point, perhaps politically or security, such that one would take advantage of the technology even at a higher cost to redress the issue of the percentage of expatriates in the Gulf?
Thank you very much. Well, thank you for all those issues and questions. I think we'll go in the order that you all spoke in. And if I say you should take 3 or 4 minutes each, you'll probably take 5. So 5 is the cut-off point, so we can finish at 12:45. Greg, do you want to start?
Sure.
I'd like you to pick up the questions that were most clearly addressed to you.
Yeah, got it.
But also perhaps in the very end of your remarks, say something about the other contributions if you wish to,
sure,
what you agree with and what you think remains open to contention.
Sure. Specifically on OPEC and discipline and OPEC quotas, of course, there's a checkered history in this. The thing that I impressionistically, my understanding in looking at this, is the thing that drives quota compliance is the price of oil. And the lower it is, the more likely OPEC players are to abide by their quotas. The other thing that drives it is fear of Saudi Arabia. I mean, to the extent that there's a fear that the Saudis will do what they did in 1985 and 86, or what they threatened to do in 1997-98, that's what drives adherence to quotas. And we're at a fairly high, right now, we're at a fairly high compliance rate. I think it's close to 80% compliance rate right now with quotas. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen, we saw a dramatic downturn in oil prices. And kind of the unnoticed story has been the semi-dramatic increase in oil prices in the last few months. I mean, by almost two-thirds. From below $30 to toward $50. And, of course, OPEC compliance has something to do with that. Of course, this is a self-defeating process, because the higher the price goes, the less likely countries are to abide by their quotas, to be tempted by short-term gain, to believe that by cheating they really aren't hurting, they won't be found out, the whole tragedy of the commons issue. And so I think that it's a cyclical thing, and only if Saudi Arabia plays the policeman role, which is and makes credible threats, which the higher the price gets, the less credible Saudi threats become, will OPEC discipline remain. So I do think that those are the dynamics driving that. Popular opinion in globalization. I think here in the Gulf, right, as opposed to the United States or Europe or China or Japan, I think here in the Gulf, popular opinion about globalization is not an economic issue. It's a cultural issue. Right? It has to do much less with how invested, both literally and figuratively, are we as economies in the world economy, and much more with, should we have movie theaters in Saudi Arabia? Right? Right? What kind of popular entertainments are acceptable in Dubai in a rollicking economy, and what kind of popular entertainments are acceptable in a downturned economy? Right? We see new regulations being discussed in Dubai about what public behaviors are acceptable. And so I think that here in the Gulf, the popular debate about globalization, right, will revolve around those social and cultural issues. Now, I don't think that that's a big problem for most states in the Gulf, right? If you will, more conservative social mores has been the trend in most of the countries in the Gulf in the past 25, 30 years. The only place where it could have an economic effect is, of course, where tourism and particularly foreign tourism, not local regional tourism, has become a major issue, and that is primarily Dubai, but also to some extent Bahrain. Demographic structures of the Gulf. To me, I don't see any way to change the demographics of this region short of a profound economic downturn here in the region. I think for most people who live in this region, the demographics work. There are, of course, fears on the cultural level, particularly in places where the local population is a small minority of the total population, the UAE and Qatar, right, specifically. There's a fear about the long-term social and cultural implications, but very little willingness on the part of governments to do anything about it, and very little willingness on the part of the people who are concerned about this to accept the economic changes that would be, the immediate economic changes that would be necessary to change the demographic structure. One final comment on this. There were two communities of foreign workers in the Gulf region who everybody thought would be particularly politically problematic to deal with. They were Yemenis in Saudi Arabia and Palestinians here in Kuwait, right? Because these were populations that spoke the local language, right, that could integrate into the culture, and that could perhaps raise political demands. Right? But what we saw in the Gulf crisis of 1990-91, right, is that both of those populations were in effect ejected from those countries with hardly a ripple of impact. Ripples of impact in Yemen, ripples of impact in Jordan and Palestine, where those workers had to go back to, but hardly a ripple here in the region. And thus, I wonder if the demographics of the region are that really serious a political issue. Thanks.
Well, let me begin with the common currency and say that I don't think there are overwhelming political constraints to a common currency in the Gulf. The European experience has been that for a long time individual national governments have believed that currency sovereignty, control of the exchange rate, was a useful tool. And for as long as they believed that they could use this tool, they refused monetary integration. Finally, they came to the conclusion that the exchange rate is a stunted tool that does not serve any purpose, because as soon as you devalue, you get inflationary pressure and the real exchange rate does not change, which is exactly the experience of the UK these very days. Wait until they find out that it's not useful to have an independent pound. And then they will, once they are convinced, become convinced that the pound is useless, they will come on board. I think the Gulf, they have reached, you have reached this conclusion a long time ago. None of the Gulf countries has effectively ever used the exchange rate as a policy tool. It has been kept pegged to the dollar, even in Kuwait, when, although formally it is not, but in fact the variation in the exchange rate have been minimal. And you cannot think of a situation in which there are serious changes in the Kuwait dollar exchange rate. which takes me to the point raised by Rodney, and I will give a very synthetic and perhaps obscure answer. I think, you see, the dollar peg is and pricing of the of oil in dollars is a situation in which the government takes the full risk of variability in the oil purchasing power, so to speak. Okay, the government receives income in a foreign currency and has the bulk of its expenditure in the national currency. So if the value of the source of income, which is oil, varies, it is reflected in changes in government income and in the balance of the government budget. If you price oil in the national currency, and especially if you move in the direction of stabilizing that price, the two are not necessarily together, you are shifting the burden of changes in the purchasing power of oil from the government to whoever receives a fixed income in the national currency. Okay, so you are making the government immune from that variation, because I will always receive the same sum in Kuwaiti dinars or Saudi riyals, and it's the problem of the people to whom I pay the problem, or the opportunity of the people to whom I pay salaries. They will have salaries that are widely changing in terms of their purchasing power. I don't think that the latter is a good solution politically for anybody, not for the people who are not ready to shoulder the burden of this instability, not for the governments who are losing a fundamental development tool. So currency for oil pricing, perhaps we might move in that direction, but I'm not so keen. Expatriates in the Gulf, of course, we should have talked about expatriates, and I think it's very important to acknowledge that today this is one key dimension of the Gulf-Asia relationship. The Gulf-Asia relationship is based on certain key pillars. One pillar is the fact that it is Asia that has the incremental demand for oil and gas. The second pillar is that it is Asia that potentially offers the best market for the petrochemicals and the other energy-intensive products that the Gulf can produce, while Europe has always, and the United States have always resisted Gulf countries integrating into downstream refining and petrochemicals production. And the third pillar is that much of the population in this part of the world is Asian. Have we, when is the tipping point? I think the tipping point is with us, and has been with us for a long time. The Gulf countries should aggressively move towards increasing productivity by limiting, restricting the inflow of foreign workers, increasing the cost of labor, and incentivizing the adoption of labor-saving techniques. And this is not being done, and I am afraid this is a strategic mistake. And I say so. So... finally, let me say the following. I think we have to keep in mind what is the long-term interest of development in the Gulf countries, which is different from making good investment in equities. Today, it might be a very good idea to invest in American equities. And I, as an investor, if I had any money, I lost all that I had, would follow this advice. But is this an advice which is useful in terms of developing the countries here? I dare say it is not. Even if we are we have ahead of us a period of very intensive new technological progress. Let me ask you, I mean, who is producing those personal computers, the laptops? I mean, are they have been invented by the British universities, the American universities, but they are produced in China. So the nanotubes and all these beautiful things, which I don't understand, they will be invented by our universities, but they will not be produced by our factories, unless we change something. And I think that's something that is up to be changed.
Thank you. So, Will, as there are several challenges to you in the last remarks. I don't think you should be too distracted by the pound issue. So, leaving the pound aside, it would be good if you took up the questions you wanted and then perhaps came back to the final disagreements.
Well, I'm actually in favour of Britain joining the Euro. With Howard, who's also in favour.
We're the only two.
We are the two, the three. We found something extraordinary. We found three people who are in favour of... I'm intellectually persuaded of your case. Look, there was a question put earlier, which we didn't answer, about, I mean, shouldn't we be investing in our own economies rather than investing in foreign equity? And I don't see it as a kind of, you know, either or. Norway has built up a large superannuation fund from its oil revenues, and it invested in partly in global equity in order to have a large pension fund to pay actually pensions for Norwegians, partly for the state to borrow against when the gets into economic difficulties, and partly actually to support infrastructure investment in Norway. And I don't see them as kind of either ors. All I was trying to do was to point out that, you know, when you've got large amounts of money in excess of a trillion, you're holding a significant part of it in cash, there is a very attractive option on the table for part of that money. Does that mean I don't think that the Gulf states should invest in Kuwait in particular in its kind of infrastructure, its knowledge economy base? I certainly don't. In fact, I advocated that in my presentation. But capitalism is hard to do. This is what I want to try to say as clearly as I can. It's not. I mean, the Chinese have embarked on a market reform program in 1979, and here they are in 2009. And in some respects, it's been fantastic what's been achieved in China, but the hard bit lies ahead. You know, building the legal system, the accounting system, the auditing system, the corporate governance system, the innovation system, actually just the human resource systems for promoting people or adjudicating in disputes is between staff members and managers and employees is really, really hard. And it's not as if you can go along on a supermarket shelf and say, well, I'll have a bit of that and a bit of that, and I'll have the institutions that will give me my capitalism. Capitalism is a complex mix between a kind of hard infrastructure of incentives and the profit motive and property rights and soft institutions. And here's my point, is that it's very difficult to create, and it's very hard for Gulf states to create them. The Chinese haven't got them, and one of the reasons that corruption is so rife in China, and as the head of the Chinese Environmental Protection Agency is on record as saying, and his deputy, that, that China's inability to get to meet its targets for carbon dioxide emissions and sulfur dioxide emissions in its 11th year plan, between 2005 and 2010, was largely because China does not possess the soft institutions that make capitalism effective. There's no watchdog function, there's no independent press, there's no independent trade unions, there's no independent auditing. You can't have elected representatives to whom you can, you know, who will challenge the polluters. And in any consequence, China continues to have, you know, extraordinary increases in carbon dioxide emissions, from 5 gigatons in 2005 to close to 8.5 gigatons in 2010, which was projected by the International Energy Agency in Paris to actually come through in 2030. That's the degree to which China has not met its own plans. And this is what I'm trying to say also about Asia and its temptations. I'm struck every time I'm in a particular Asian country how encircled it feels. I mean, India feels encircled by Pakistan, the Kashmir, the China to the north. It's got turbulence on its other borders in Sri Lanka and in Burma or Myanmar, depending on where you want to, what you want to call it. You're in Singapore, and Singapore feels beleaguered by Malaysia, Indonesia. In China, it feels equally encircled. There's a tremendous, tremendous sense of encirclement or near paranoia in lots of individual Asian countries. And they're also struggling to develop the soft institutions that make capitalism very, very effective. What they've had is they've had kind of state support institutions and a huge export drive, which has been very successful, particularly with the West kind of running these kind of bubble economies that they have run, so that exports from China to the United States have been much higher than would otherwise have been because the way the world has been set up. Those days are over. And I think the mix of consumer products, state-driven kind of export drives, and lack of these soft institutions are going to present Asia with very considerable challenges. And a number of chief executives of Fortune 500 companies and FTSE 100 companies in Britain tell me that, and lots of Asian entrepreneurs tell me that too. So, this doesn't mean that one then neglects Asia. One just, has, and when it looks at it realistically, and of course it's a major opportunity, and some of the points you made about the deals that can be done by Gulf states on petrochemicals are very attractive and should be done, but as the locomotive of the world economy in the next 25 years, it's not going to be. Of the centre of gravity of innovation and economic and political decision making, it's not going to be. That's what I mean. I don't mean there aren't great opportunities there. There are. Nor do I mean that Asia is going to stay that way. But it's going to have a very difficult few years, in my view. Because a big lesson, surely, of the last 5 or 10 years is that we've got to do capitalism at home and abroad more fairly. And the point that was made about the big build-up of these foreign exchange reserves after the Asian financial crisis is well made. But that's because the international financial system was so extraordinarily unfair that Asian countries that had those runs on their currencies in the late 1990s and had declines in GDP at 12, 15, Indonesia's case, it had a decline in GDP of 20%, for God's sake, as a result of foreign exchange speculation. They said, never again are we going to suffer from this unfair international financial order. We will make it fair for us. But actually, they displaced the unfairness, if you like, into America, Britain, and Europe. And then another set of unfairnesses took hold. Grotesquely unfair remuneration for the people who ran banks. Grotesquely unfair deals that were done by bankers hiding the quality of the assets they were selling to investors and disguising them. There are, 25 to 26 Fortune 500 companies with AAA ratings on their bonds. There are 64,000 structured investment vehicles that credit rating agencies gave AAA ratings to. What was going on there except lying, systemic unfairness in the way the banking community dealt with its savers and its investors? And the lesson, surely, is that at home and abroad, we have to have a fairer capitalism. And that fairer capitalism has to have these soft institutions I've talked about. It has to have its checks and balances. It has to recognize that capitalism really only works when you actually start talking about business purpose rather than just about making short-term profits, and doesn't matter how they're made. How pounds or dinars or dollars of profit are made really, really matters. So this then comes to how we're going to win popular support for a fairer capitalism. Well, I think as soon as political and business leaders start talking about a fairer capitalism, I think the discourse will start to change. It's one of the reasons why I'm strongly in favour of congressional moves to tax bonuses by 90%. I thought it was extraordinary that the 400 men who created close to $80 billion of losses in AIG should then actually say, well, you must honour the bonus contracts that we signed 18 months ago and give us $160 million in bonuses. Some of them receiving bonuses of $3, $4, $5 million for an organisation that would have been bust without the US taxpayer. And I understand the strength of feeling in America about that, just as I have to understand the strength of feeling in Britain about some of the pension payments that were made to executives who led their organisations into, let's say it honestly, bankruptcy. There should be, in the West, if you like, Nuremberg trials for bankers whilst we launch a Marshall Plan for the banking system. And that's the way you handle the politics of this, it seems to me. You know, if you don't underwrite our financial systems in the way the British, Americans and Europeans are doing, where the system, you know, the whole economy would go down. And the politics of this, I think, you know, is of that type. And,
Bill,
actually, and just to finish off, I think inflation is a less big enemy than unemployment, Mark. I think that in my country, Britain, there are 600,000 college leavers between 16 and 21, school leavers coming off the labour market this summer. I don't think half of them will get employment. And the impact of unemployment on young people is devastating. Inflation, they can live with. And inflation, this kind of reification of inflation as the big ogre that's going to come and eat us all up, and not worrying about things like innovation, employment, welfare, well-being, happiness, seems to me ludicrous. We, at the moment, the economic house in the West is burning. We must douse the flames. The kind of instruments that have been adopted by the British, the Americans, the Europeans and the G20 are, I think, going to work. You are right to say they are pregnant with inflationary danger in the years ahead. We will deal with that then. Let's not have mass unemployment and depression disfiguring global capitalism, much more threatening for its legitimacy and much more threatening for the sustainability of the order. Thank you.